Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
When I was reading Middlemarch for the first time, it was as if George Eliot was the sort of God. And when I finished reading it, I thought, oh, I'm going to be lonely again now. Because while I was reading it, I didn't feel alone. I felt with the characters. I knew what the characters were feeling. I knew that George Eliot knew about them. And there was some sort of community going on there. And I knew that George Eliot would be able, as it were, to explain somebody like me. And as I stopped reading the book, I thought, I'm on my own again now.
You can no more draw one more lesson from our books than you can from life itself. You may draw 1,000 if you will, but merely to read one of our books in an impressionable mood is to see such a portion of the world with her eyes and to share in the multiform influence exercised by the vision. The words of British writer, trade union activist and feminist Edith Simcox, who was a lifelong friend and admirer of Victorian novelist George Eliot. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Can great art teach us how to live? Well, on tonight's show, we're going to unpack that question with one of the greatest writers of Victorian literature, the great George Eliot. Think classics such as Middlemarch, The Mill on the Floss, Silas Marner and Adam Bede. Yep, novels of intense emotion, empathy and psychological depth. This evening, I'm joined by writer, literary scholar and teacher Philip Davis, whose latest book, The Transferred Life of George Eliot, has just been published by Oxford University Press, where Philip informs his readers, my primary aim is to understand her life through her work, because it was her work that she transferred and dedicated her life. So what did it mean for George Eliot to be a realist writer? And was George Eliot the greatest philosopher writer of the Victorian era?
My name is Philip Davis. I'm a professor of literature at the University of Liverpool, where I also run a research unit called QuILLS. It's the Centre for Research into Reading, Literature and Society. And all that that means is that we do research into reading groups, shared reading groups, often run by our sister organisation, The Reader, which takes serious literature to hard-to-reach communities, not in those sorts of reading groups where you read everything in advance, but where it's read live and on the spot. I've written recently this book about George Eliot. I've written about the Victorians, a volume, because I'm very interested in that period that brings literature, particularly in relation to the realist novel and ordinary doings. But I've also written on William Shakespeare, Samuel Johnson, William Wordsworth. I've never wanted to be a specialist. I wanted to be a literary middleman between authors and readers trying to transmit the messages or show the importance to me of those books. This is a personal thing.
Well, Philip, you're an exemplary middleman, and I have to say hats off to you for producing such an interesting and candid biography of the great George Eliot. I might start off with a big wide open question for you, if that's okay. Did George Eliot really interrogate truth at every level? And within that, was she working off a kind of a higher consciousness of sorts? Because she really was able to see, interrogate and analyse the world in so many different ways.
Most of her interrogation, as you call it, arise out of emotional problems and human needs. She is not a dry intellectual. She uses thinking in relation to human problems. It's not going to necessarily produce solutions, but she wants places in which to do that thinking. And she believes increasingly in her life that novels, realist novels, are the best places where people can do thinking about existence. So although she was an extraordinarily intelligent woman, knowing many languages, translating, reviewing, all that intelligence is meant to be in the service of something more important than intelligence.
You describe her as a quintessential novelist and as a great transmitter. And I'm just wondering, do you think she really wanted the reader to maybe question their world around them, question their existence, and to maybe look deeply at the world? Like that she set out almost to teach her readers in some way? Or is that too strong?
It's not too strong. She wanted the novel not just to be a form of entertainment, but something very serious. On the other hand, she didn't want just to be a teacher in the dullest sort of way, passing on some sort of lessons or messages. I wonder if I could, would it be all right to give you an example about that? So here's an example of somebody, a man called Lydgate, doctor from Middlemarch, who's got a difficult marriage with his beautiful wife, Rosamond. They are not getting on, but he still wants them to carry on, as he says, loving each other. And the secret sentences that he says in his mind that George Eliot picks up and transmits are these. In marriage, the certainty, she will never love me much, is easier to bear than the fear, I shall love her no more. In other words, the one thought he's trying to avoid is, I shall love her no more, because that would be the end of everything. So what he will put up with, and only half recognize that he's putting up with it, is the sentence, she will never love me much. Now that's the sort of compromise that George Eliot is interested in. Not the dramatic thing, I won't love her anymore, let's get divorced, I want to kill her. No, it's the grey area, she will never love me much.
It's the messy, mundane stuff, isn't it, Philip, that we all have to experience throughout our lives. And it's not necessarily, as you said, the dramatic that she excels in.
Why she is, I saying, the great representative novelist is that she's a great representative realist novelist. And so within our ordinary lives, we keep thinking, oh, we'll make do. We're never going to come to much. It's all right. We manage. And of course, that's our outward story. Even the story we tell ourselves in order to cope. But inside, George Eliot knows there is a hidden drama that doesn't look dramatic, but is to do with people's struggling, people's unhappinesses, their lack of vocation, or their thwarted needs. This is about ordinary human secrets, the private things that hurt.
You quote the psychologist James Sully. He was a young attendant at a Sunday afternoon intellectual gathering that George Eliot and a range of different leftists and radicals used to attend. I think it was called the Priory. Yeah. And he wrote that Eliot had a clairvoyant insight into the mind and character, which enabled her to get at once in spiritual touch with a stranger.
Yeah.
And she was able to in some way tap her speech and how the words that she chose. She was very clever in how she reached out to different people in the group. It really shows her extraordinary gift in terms of her psychological capabilities, doesn't it?
It does, and it was very important to her that she should do it not only on the page as a novelist, but in her own life, in order to think about people, to listen to people, to imagine what they were really saying. You hear their ordinary script, but the job of the novelist in real life was to hear what was beneath it, to imagine that. And she wanted to be as sympathetic in real life as she was on the page. She knew, however, that come away from the page and she wouldn't be. That's one of the powerful, painful contradictions for her, that she could write better than she could live.
How much of her own personal struggles comes through in the literature? I know that she had a tricky-ish relationship with her mother, but I'm just wondering, her early childhood, it wasn't necessarily troubled, but it wasn't very happy either.
She loved her father, and he was the great, secure figure for her from her childhood onwards. The relationship with the mother seems more distant, and it was always the case that her relationships with men seemed stronger from that point onwards than her relationships with women. She loved her brother Isaac. Trouble was that though in many ways it was a happy childhood, this was a girl of very powerful feelings, very strong thoughts, and increasingly as she grew, she was going to come into conflict with provincial Coventry, provincial Nuneaton, the countryside and towns where she was reared. So her father, a very respectable woodsman and estate manager, provided great moral backbone, would always support her, until the point when in the course of her intellectual adventures, she wanted to give up on Christianity. And she told her father one day that she didn't want to go to church with him anymore. And he was devastated. Looking back, years later, she thought she'd handled it badly. She was so keen on establishing her principles that she'd hurt her father. Her father wasn't reasonable. He seemed to be threatening to throw her out. But she thought, really, she was the more powerful vessel. She was the person who knew more, who should have been able to manage it. And in the end, she did manage it by compromising, by going back to church with her father, not for the sake of a God that she no longer believed in, but for the sake of her father's human feelings. She didn't care too much that it looked as if she was giving in. She knew inside, at a different level, she wasn't. And that was one of the great pains for her, that, as we all know, you can love your father, your mother, your relatives, your friends, but there's always a thought, sometimes a critical thought, that cuts across that. And we have to live with that mixture of love and judgment. I'd like to read you, if I may, Sue, just a short paragraph, which is from Adam Bede, and is about families and the tensions within them. It's a novel that springs out of her own youthful experience. I'll read it. Family likeness has often a deep sadness in it. Nature, that great tragic dramatist, knits us together by bone and muscle and divides us by the subtler web of our brains, blends yearning and repulsion, and ties us by our heartstrings to the beings that jar us at every movement. We hear a voice with a very cadence of our own uttering thoughts we despise. We see eyes so like our mother's, averted from us in cold alienation, and our last darling child startles us with the air and gestures of the sister we parted from in bitterness long years ago. The father to whom we owe our best heritage galls us, puts us to shame by his daily errors. The long-lost mother, whose face we begin to see in the glass as our own wrinkles come, once fretted our young souls with her anxious humours and irrational persistence. You see the point? You're tied to them, biologically, physically, also emotionally. And yet at another level, you've outgrown them, you're fed up with them, and you're also conflicted, ashamed of those feelings. And this is done by George Eliot's wonderful writing of sentences that combine two things, the attraction and the repulsion, the love and the critical thought. And it's her job, she believes, to hold those tensions together in her sentences, as we have to hold them together in our heads and hearts.
And Philip, it's something that we can all relate to whatever degree. I'm just wondering, her mother never visited her in boarding school. I know her mum eventually died of breast cancer, but it seemed to have been quite a cold and lonely experience with her mother, was it?
Yes, it seems so. There's a great moment in the middle on the floss when Maggie, the protagonist who is based on Mary Ann Evans, who became George Eliot, when Maggie is in terrible trouble, social isolation, everybody is fed up with her, and the mother, that she's rather despised compared to her father, suddenly turns round and says the one sentence that Mary Ann Evans, that George Eliot never heard in her own life. Maggie Tulliver's mother says to her, "In this trouble, you've got a mother." And I think that George Eliot, Mary Ann Evans as she was called, never had that sentence. Always seemed without her mother, whether her mother was depressed or poorly, we don't fully know. But she didn't have that.
Her brother Isaac was brutally judgmental of her different decisions. They were clearly politically and emotionally and socially such different people, they were wired so differently.
Yes.
But he almost tried to control her, didn't he?
And she, at one level, knew that, and at another level, loved him. It's those levels, the refusal of a simplification that says, my brother is just a bully. She was separated from him for many long years because, in her emotional neediness, the man that she found that she wanted to marry was already married. Isaac was a very conventional man. He couldn't bear it that she was living, inverted commas, in sin with a married man. And so he cut her off. She had to learn to bear that. She suffered from it. She wrote the novel Mill on the Floss out of that pain. And eventually, after George Henry Lewis, her common law husband, died, she married very late on a much younger man, actually married him, and then, for a wonder, Isaac got back in touch. She could have been bitter, but she was simply, I'm afraid, simply very glad, after all that pain, that there was some sort of reunion.
She didn't have much of a reunion with her sister Chrissy. I think her brother Isaac banned her older sister from visiting her or writing to her because he didn't approve of her psycho-emotional or psychosexual relationships of sorts.
That's right. I mean, Marion Evans would have been hurt and angry at that. But you see, George Eliot, who she became, would have understood why, with whatever faults in him, Isaac had decided to do that. The portrait of Isaac as a version of Tom Tulliver in Mill on the Floss shows a person who is at once narrow-minded and also wonderfully focused. It's he who can rescue his father from bankruptcy as the woman can't. George Eliot could see all the sides. And that is an almost unbearable reality for us. We would prefer to have one thought, I hate you, or I don't care anymore. For George Eliot, she knew they were crude reactions and not true to our own inner reality of feeling.
I loved reading about Barbara Bodichon, Philip. She really got George Eliot. She recognised her through her characters. She understood her and was a very good friend to her, wasn't she?
Yes, Barbara Bodichon, Barbara Lee Smith, as she was originally called, was a very lively, spirited young woman who, like Marion Evans, went through a lot of heartaches in her relationships with men. But she had an enormous amount of courage and independence, and she loved her friend. The sign of that love for Marion Evans, George Eliot, was that when that first novel came out, because it came out under the pseudonym of George Eliot, it was Barbara Bodichon who recognized that it was Marion Evans. Nothing could have pleased the author more than to be known. At some level, of course, she used the pseudonym in order not to be known, in order not to be associated with someone who is living with a man who is not married, for example, or to avoid the prejudice against women writers.
You referenced J.W. Cross, George Eliot's first biographer, and I was surprised by how honest and anxious and how despairing George Eliot was of what she thought would be her future. She said to him in an interview, and it's so personal and so honest, "The only thing I should ever care much to dwell on will be the absolute despair I suffered from of ever being able to achieve anything." When you think that she is possibly the greatest Victorian writer, it's remarkable how self-critical she was, isn't it?
It's remarkable how insecure she was. George Henry Lewis, her common law husband, had to hide reviews from her, had to ask publishers not to send her any critical remarks at all because she would get disheartened and depressed immediately. Every time she was depressed in the middle of a book, she'd turn back to her notes from in her diary about writing the previous book, and she began to see she'd felt the same previously. So she just had to get used to the depression, the despair, the self-criticism. But she never was able to get rid of it. Johnny Cross was the young man that she married many years her junior after the death of George Henry Lewis, towards the end of her life, needing somebody to look after her, because that's always the key. She needed to be loved. She needed to be able to have somebody to really talk to. Cross was like a sort of nephew who then looked after her in those later years. He was himself depressive and at one point said that he found her books melancholy. Instead of thinking, as she might, that this was a sign of his own depression, she was just very, very upset. She was thin-skinned, but she was also very frightened if that's all her novels did. She didn't want to just be a teacher, and she didn't want to just be a pessimist. So although she was dealing with hard and often sad human problems, she wanted her books not to be melancholy. She wanted them to give people some sort of strength, some sort of belief, some sort of strong emotions in the midst of things.
Is Middlemarch her greatest book, do you think? I presume you've read it umpteen times.
Umpteen times. I think it is her greatest book. And I remember the first time that I read it when I would be perhaps 16, 17. And what I loved was the way that she was able to put in the background, the context, the unspoken thoughts of every character. And I thought to myself, I can't even do that for myself, but I wish there was somebody who could explain me, put in the faults, but also the mitigations that I'd be known. Of course, you'd be quite frightened of anybody knowing you that way, especially as you grew up away from your parents. And perhaps the only, is it a person? Not really. The only person that you would think traditionally could do that would be God. Well, when I was reading Middlemarch for the first time, it was as if George Eliot was a sort of God. And when I finished reading it, I thought, oh, I'm going to be lonely again now. Because while I was reading it, I didn't feel alone. I felt with the characters. I knew what the characters were feeling. I knew that George Eliot knew about them. And there was some sort of community going on there. And I knew that George Eliot would be able, as it were, to explain somebody like me. And as I stopped reading the book, I thought, I'm on my own again now.
Speaking of God, how would you describe her relationship, or how would you describe her spiritual framework of sorts? Because she had quite an on-off relationship with God. She produced some tremendous writing, and there is such a moralistic and ethical frame to all her writing. But yeah, it's not straightforward. Sure, it's not.
No, she gave up her belief. She had very strong evangelical beliefs in God as a young woman. She wanted that certainty. She lost that certainty as a result of her thinking and her reading, and as I say, didn't want to go to church anymore with her father. When she turned to writing, it wasn't in some sort of cynical way. This was still, in terms of the experiments of life, attempts to find meaning and purpose. It was a sort of agnostic religious endeavor. God wasn't going to appear in this, but all those religious feelings that she valued, she wanted to retain.
I was very interested in what you wrote about Tolstoy. You mentioned that Tolstoy loved Adam Bede. He thought it was just one of the best books that he'd ever read.
Yeah.
And it got me thinking, and I'm not sure it's the nicest thing to do, you know, Tolstoy and George Eliot both are masters of marriage and writing about the pains and frustrations and distractions within marriage and the suffering. And I'm just wondering, is it fair to compare them? Can we put them, are they like, they're two extraordinary joints of literature. But I'm just wondering, who do you think writes marriage and its frustrations best?
the great impossible question.
Maybe we'll just go, maybe we'll just go for love first and then we'll move on to marriage. It's a very difficult one, isn't it?
It's a very difficult one.
Because I spent the weekend trying to think about it, and it's hard, isn't it?
It's very hard. Tolstoy, I'm thinking here of Anna Karenina, still comes through at the end of that book with Levin as a believer. And there is that strong drive in Tolstoy towards some sort of religious faith. George Eliot has to be more immersed in the day-to-day. There isn't going to be a religious solution.
There's no resolve, though, in Georgia. There's no real resolve in George Eliot. There's no great happy endings. There's no easy conclusions.
No, there isn't. But then there isn't in Tolstoy either, is there? If you think of the death of Ivan Illich, then he has to go all the way through that death. So Tolstoy is probably the most outstanding writer of birth and death and those terrible passages. And he's very like George Eliot in this respect, that it's all very well for Ivan Illich on the verge of death to think about the word death, but he suddenly realizes that he can't quite believe in the thing. And that flip from the word to actually experiencing the reality that the word describes, that's the mark of both of these great novelists. In marriage, well, there's wonderful happy marriages as well as unhappy marriages in Tolstoy. But I think the great struggles of George Eliot's wives to be able to keep marriages going. I'm thinking here of Dorothea in Middlemarch. She is foolishly married an aged scholar, dry, and she has to learn that she's not going to be his great pupil, his great helpmate. She's just going to be ignored by him because he cannot bear her to know how impotent he is, how much of a failure he is, and therefore he's unkind to her. As she begins to see, to imagine what it's like to be him, she realizes that she has to be, quote, she has to be the mercy for those sorrows of his. Doesn't say piteous, sympathetic towards, merciful towards. She says the mercy. It's as if human beings need the mercy to be in the world. If God isn't there to give it, then some human being has to do it. In this case, the wife who is hurt by her husband nonetheless finds it within herself because she knows his weaknesses to try to be the mercy for those sorrows. So if there are qualities that we need in the world, that God isn't going to provide, that we need in our marriages or wherever, then we have to provide them. It's not fair that there's no fantasy God. It's not fair that they often have to be provided by people who are suffering rather than by those who are on top. Dorothea suffers at the hands of Casaubon and still tries to be merciful towards him. That's a decision. It's not victimization. It's a complicated decision. It's like Marian Evans compromising with her father, going to church. It looks like submission. It wasn't submission. Dorothea, feeling sorry for the aging Casaubon and trying to help him through his latter years instead of kicking him. It isn't victimization. It's an attempt to do something in the middle of things. And I love that sense in George Eliot of the middle way. Half compromised, not looking heroic, but struggling on. And that's why marriage for her was the great thing. Because there was the proximity. There was the continuance day after day. It was for her, in its subdued way, the great drama. So, if I'm going for birth or I'm going for death, to answer your question as best I can, I'll go for Tolstoy, and if I'm going for marriage, I'll go for George Eliot. God help me, I should never have made those choices.
What about Maggie Tulliver? Is she one of the greatest and most pragmatic characters that George Eliot wrote?
She's certainly a passionate account of George Eliot's own young womanhood. At one point, to give you an example, if I may, Maggie falls in love with the fiancé of her cousin. It's typical of the sort of messes that Marian Evans, the young George Eliot, got into. And worse, she loves Stephen, Maggie, and she's tempted to go off with him. They get on a boat together to elope, knowing, of course, what damage this will do to the cousin and the family and the scandal that it will provoke. Halfway along the journey, Maggie decides she can't go through with it. She gets off the boat and comes back home to face outrage. This is typical of George Eliot and of the realist novel of being in that middle ground. That's to say, Maggie could have simply decided not to go with Stephen, not to have any loving relationship with him, and there she would have been, respectable and pure and resigned in a way that people often think is the Victorian way. On the other hand, she could have gone off with Stephen, as she seemed she was going to, in some powerful liberation, and maybe after some time of living with him, they could have become respectably married even, and then been accepted by everybody, though there was a difficult period in between. Neither of those alternatives. It's the worst of both worlds. That's to say, she starts off, and then the morality of what she's doing comes in, and she has to go back. She goes back without a husband, without a lover, and without any approval. That's when she needs support. That's when George Eliot most admires her, because she's not entirely innocent and she is not guilty.
And I suppose that's why her readers love her, because there's such pragmatism, realism and grit entwined in such craft, isn't there? She said that my writing is simply a set of experiments in life.
Yeah.
In ways, all her books are experiments, aren't they?
Yes. Experiments, for example, in that sexual relationship with Stephen, in not knowing the relationship between sexual desire and duty, in having always to try to work it out. What readers love, I imagine, is the messiness, those terrible areas of conflict and confusion where you seem pulled every which way. And George Eliot is the great psychologist. She is the person who understands those conflicts.
Thank you.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's great to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm talking with writer, literary critic and teacher Philip Davis on his latest book, The Transferred Life of George Eliot, which has just been published by Oxford University Press. I asked Philip about some of the great boundary-breaking questions in George Eliot's fiction and how subsequent novelists and essayists, such as Dan Jacobson, have carried forward her questions.
Yes, you're referring to the critic and novelist Dan Jacobson. And one of the things I try to do in the book is to show how modern-day novelists, Dan has only died in the last few years, modern-day novelists follow in the tradition of George Eliot. So Dan Jacobson writes, I think this is the place you must be thinking of, "What if the world proves itself to be quite other than the place we had previously imagined it to be? If fate or our own choice or some unfathomable mixture of both fate and choice plunges us suddenly into a wholly different context, into a war, a natural catastrophe, a prison, or a hospital." For example, in Adam Bede, is that a pretty but silly young girl falls in love with the local squire. He recklessly leaves her pregnant, goes to the army without knowing her full condition, and she then tries to follow him. And suddenly, what before had been just a silly girl, you might say, if you were cruel, becomes, in the course of her solitary journey in strange lands, on her own, bearing the pregnancy, she suddenly becomes tossed into the wild area of life, across the boundary into some other side. She's like a limited person in a limitless condition now. And for George Eliot, that blows everything wide open, because it's not just mundane reality that she's interested in. It's the hidden inner reality, or what happens at moments of crisis. Mm. She says in George Eliot, in relation to what she calls ordinary life, "If we had a keen vision and feeling of all ordinary life, it would be like hearing the grass grow or the squirrel's heart beat. And we should die of that roar which lies on the other side of silence."
It's terrific stuff. You bring up the great German philosopher Nietzsche. He wasn't a fan of her rational morality, and he really didn't like her. Sure he didn't.
No, I mean, Nietzsche was the philosopher who coined the phrase, as translated, "the death of God." And if God was dead, he wanted him to be dead and buried. What he didn't like about George Eliot was that she'd kicked out the Christian religion, but still kept Christian emotions of tolerance, sympathy, and so on. He wanted a completely fresh start, a new morality, something that was less compromised than he believed George Eliot's views were. George Eliot would have said that that was juvenile, that you couldn't simply get rid of the past and start again, nor was it desirable. Because even if God was a fiction, human beings had put a lot of faith, a lot of values, a lot of culture into God-inspired lives. We had to live without God now, but we needed to use human qualities that had been inspired by Judaism, Christianity, the great religions. We had to use them for human sake. Nietzsche didn't believe that. He thought she was a terrible compromiser. I've been trying to say to you again and again, if you admire George Eliot, you'll have to admire the value of deep compromise. Mm-hmm. Not as a way of giving in, but as a way of having to deal with 3, 4, 5 different factors at the same time and not simply go for one simple act of rebellion or victimization.
What did you make of Daniel Deronda?
I think that Middlemarch is the greatest of her novels, and I think that Daniel Deronda, which is the last of her model novels and comes straight after Middlemarch, is daring in its experiment. It is the one that tries to take on board her insecurities about vocation, belief, whether there is a better, a new future for human beings. And in that way, as I think you're suggesting, she takes on the criticisms of a Nietzsche and tries to imagine a future.
Yeah.
It's a bold novel because A lot of the time it's dealing in ideas that have not yet come to fruition, ideas about some better world. And there are idealists like Mordecai, a Jewish thinker, who is trying before his life ends to pass on some of those ideas and ideals to some soul who believes in them, who could be like Barbara Bodichon to George Eliot, a kindred spirit. So this time, at the end, instead of it being a tale of provincial life, it is a desperate attempt in the face of a world in England that seems to her worn out and lacking in purpose, to imagine a possible future. I love it when novelists take great risks.
Yeah, it's ambitious, isn't it?
Instead of writing a perfect work, write something that is a great venture into the unknown.
Well, it shows a huge amount of confidence that she was able to reinvent herself or her creative vision in some way, that she was able to do something and risk whether it was going to be a failure or not, that she actually had that courage, doesn't it?
And it's interesting, alongside what you were saying before, that she has this courage alongside a complete lack of confidence. How was she able to hold all these different things together? But that's what she knew as a novelist, that we do struggle to hold a lot of conflicting things together. And she managed to be simultaneously unconfident and yet in her writing use that to understand people who are not confident and to drive herself into risks so that she wasn't simply settling for third or fourth best. Every novel was a terrible, terrible venture in which she thought she'd never get to the end. So her lack of confidence made her rawer, made her have to fight harder and never be complacent.
Her writing, though, clearly took a huge whack out of her.
Yeah.
But that seemed to have been a recurring pattern all through her life, that she took on these great demands, that she charged through them, and she gave everything that she had, didn't she?
Yes. She, as we say, always wanted to bite off more than she could chew. That was the point of intelligence. You had to feed it with more than could simply produce pat answers. Also, she wanted to see as many different characters, as many different points of view, almost simultaneously in any of her novels, and to shift from one person to another. So this is like a human being, by the act of writing, becoming almost superhuman. So many characters, so many conflicts, so many emotions in search of thoughts. That's the pressure that she put herself under. And when she was writing Middlemarch, she would be writing about, say, those moments when Dorothea could be compassionate, even to the man who'd hurt her, Casaubon. And then she'd find that in her own life, just as she was going to be writing Middlemarch the next day, she'd been thoughtlessly critical to one friend about the behavior of another friend. She then thought to herself, look at the hypocrisy here. Here I am, the great novelist, so it seems, laying down the law, trying to say how important compassion is. And I go back to being Marianne Lewis, Marianne Evans, married to George Henry Lewis, although the marriage is never accepted. And what do? I just become like everybody else again, critical and gossipy and so on. And it distressed her while she was being almost superhuman in the writing of Middlemarch that she was still horribly, flawedly human the next day, the minutes before writing and so on. And yet, of course, if she hadn't have had all those flaws, she wouldn't have been able to see so deeply into the experience of all the people that she puts into her novels. In that, she is like Tolstoy. Tolstoy said that his brother was just as good a writer as he, Leo, was. But the brother would never be as great a novelist as Leo Tolstoy because, said Leo Tolstoy, his brother had never made so many mistakes. And George Eliot felt all the time that she'd made mistakes. They weren't huge mistakes. They weren't murders. They weren't crimes. But they were constantly painful to her in terms of betrayals, thoughtlessnesses, unkindnesses, as if there were real failures in her of the sort of human being she wanted to be and she wanted to live among. That hurt her more than anything.
How do you explain her wedding night to John Cross? It's something that you touch on at the end of the biography. They had got, as you mentioned, he was significantly younger, I think at least 20 years younger.
Yeah.
And at the night of their, on their wedding night, he attempted to jump out of a window in Venice. And I think at there was a lot of media speculation that he didn't want to consummate his marriage. But as you mentioned, he did suffer from mental illness. So I'm just wondering, how do you as a biographer explain that?
I can't explain these things in a sense, because of course we don't really know. And my biography is also about the biography of somebody becoming a novelist, because in novels you do know, you can see the thinking. In life we're half blind. As far as the Johnny Cross episode is concerned, it's most terribly sad. It could have been that the air in Venice was particularly bad, and that destabilized him. It could have been that he was melancholy anyway, as we've said. But I think that it is possible that it was the shock that he was expected to consummate the marriage. Marianne Evans, Marianne Lewis, George Eliot, all these names, but it is still one person, was passionate. She wasn't just an ethereal being. Her relationship with George Henry Lewis, her common law husband, was passionate. I think she would have expected a physical relationship with Johnny Cross. If it's true that he jumped, what you have to imagine is all those years as a young woman when she thought she was ugly, and though clever, unwanted, all those years which she'd seemed to overcome by becoming George Eliot and so successful would have come flooding back. Ugly again, not wanted again. We don't know for certain. All I'm saying is that that would be typical of how it sometimes is in real life, as a realist novelist would know it, that there are some things that you think you've got over and they come back again. Deep flaws which we cannot fully transcend or mend, have to see coming back, have to bear. That would be quite typical of a George Eliot view of life, and she had to bear that too.
Philip, you write in your conclusions that George Eliot wanted to leave nothing unsaid, or at least unwritten. And I thought that was a very fitting and very beautiful tribute. I'm just wondering, did she achieve that, do you think, in all her books?
I think that it was unbearable for her to think things and have nobody to say them to. Of course, you can't say everything to the people around you, and that is why she became a novelist, that where speaking fails, writing begins. Even in writing, problems recur. You cannot, even in writing, say everything. But the great advantage of literature is that even when you can't fully say everything, there's a resonance, there's an emotional power around the language that tells you areas that are unspoken. So, for example, in Middlemarch, to take a very crude example, there's no talk about Dorothea's love life with Casaubon. He's an arid scholar. He's doubtless impotent on the honeymoon. She clearly is having some terrible, almost, breakdown. People will talk about Victorian prurience or the repression of the Victorian, but actually, the language is so powerful that we know what is going wrong. We know what has failed to happen. And that's just a simple example of George Eliot getting into areas where the language does enough to tell you more than itself. So yes, I think we have a lot of secrets, secret pains, secret joys, and I think George Eliot knew more of them than almost any other human being. And I think that she articulates that, and I think that we read it and we're shocked, or I am, that she knows so much. And that there it is in print, looking back at you as if it knows you. That's a wonderful and terrible achievement. Terrible because sometimes you don't want those things known. But at least in reading, it's a safe place. It's a place to do thinking. Because we are strange hybrid creatures. We want to be known, and we also need not to be known. And in that tension, the novel is a holding ground. It allows us to see those secrets, to acknowledge them, to think about them, and we're still, inverted commas, only in a novel. But actually, novels are very, very strange things indeed in opening up the language of the heart and of the mind and all those things that we don't normally talk about in society, in media, even on the radio.
That was writer, teacher and literary critic Philip Davis. The Transferred Life of George Eliot is published by Oxford University Press and retails for about €29 in hardback. I have to say, hats off to Philip. This is one expansive, perceptive and thought-provoking read. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. All that's left for me to do now is to say a very big thank you to Ronan Burnock, who helped out with this week's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the sensitive and discerning words of Philip Davis from The Transferred Life of George Eliot, where Philip concludes, "George Eliot represents the approximate effort of truth which human reality needs and fears. That is why inside the novels she is both there and not there. Not there as far as her characters can ever know. Utterly there for her readers to have a think with them. Placed between fiction and an extra literary reality in order to work across them. Fine praise indeed. Good night."
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.